It's amazing to have the sun come out, huh? Like, I had this idea California in June was like warm, you know? Not so much where I've been at least, so it's it is amazing just that the kind of relief and the and the joy. But also that you see how humbling it is too, right? To see just like this one little shift that's totally out of our control, how much of an impact it makes on our mind state, you know, this sense of if we feel hopeful or if we feel in despair can be just like so tethered to some condition that's entirely out of our control, you know. Raven agrees. And I think one of the things about this path of practice is that can be confusing, you know, and but also is so essential is to not deny the joy that comes with the sunlight, you know, and the warmth and the relief of that, you know, and the goodness of that. To take that as, you know, upliftment and if it feels uplifting, right, to take it and to feel the goodness of it and to feel the warmth of the sunlight and to, you know, be nourished by it, but also to have a sense of that the way that that nourishment is building something in us that that hopefully builds a kind of strength to be peaceful, to be accepting, to be, to have as much access to joy and equanimity, you know, even when it's cloudy. Right, the sense of like our whole world view doesn't have to shift just because one cloud goes over the sun. And yet we see how sensitive we are. We see how sensitive the heart is. And it's important to see that. But also this powerful, beautiful aspiration and ambition to encounter and to understand a deeper freedom that isn't tethered to things being one way or another. Because we see that everything is so, and ultimately when it comes down to it, so out of our control, you know, the conditions of our lives inwardly and externally. And these turbulent waters we find ourselves in. We can drown in them if we don't have some ability to see clearly, manage, you know, the inundation that we're in. There's a story I really love about a wandering philosopher, academic, and seeker, you know, in his own way, who traveled far and wide, you know, looking for all of the knowledge he could find, you know, in every different community, in every different culture, and was, you know, would speak to the elders and speak to the learned people, and he you know, he would just gather all of this information, and you know, he would travel with this, you know, big boxes and crates of books and scrolls, and he was so fascinated by philosophy and mathematics and all the knowledge that, you know, people had accumulated, and was collecting it and storing it, you know, and was so enthusiastic about it. And so one day on his journey, he comes to a really wide river, a really wide swollen river that he can't cross, of course, on his own. And so he finds a ferryman there on the banks of the river and enlists his services, you know, to pay him to ferry him across the river. And so they gather all his books and all his scrolls and all his materials, and they, you know, fill up this raft, really, a simple raft. And they start their journey across the water. And the philosopher asks the ferryman, he says, "Brother, have you ever studied philosophy?" you know, and the ferryman's there, you know, trying to navigate. And he said, no, no, I never have. And they said, oh, you've wasted half your life. Philosophy, it's so important. It's everything. And he goes on and rambles on about how important it is. And the ferryman's listening and, you know, trying to navigate the waters. And he says, well, have you at least studied mathematics? You know, no, I never have. Oh, you've wasted more than half your life. And he starts talking about, you know, astronomy and, the, you know, all the ways of calculation and how to understand the universe in that way. And the ferryman goes, and as he's listening and kind of distracting him, this, you know, the waters get very rough and they enter this very turbulent place. And the philosopher who's not paying attention and kind of, you know, being very grandiose gets things more and more unstable until finally the raft actually capsizes. And all of the books and all of the materials and everything starts flowing downstream, and the ferryman starts swimming to the shore, and he looks back and he sees the philosopher also going downstream with all the materials. And he yells to the philosopher, he says, brother, did you never learn to swim? I never did. You know, you've wasted all of your life. And so the sense of like how we use all of this knowledge, and it's so beautiful, right? The human capacity for knowing and philosophizing and thinking about things and ruminating, and you know, it's like it is amazing. You know, this mind that we all share some part of, this capacity, it's extraordinary, you know, and can be used for such good, you know. Of course it can be used for such harm. It's not to say that it's worthless, right, or that it doesn't have its value. But there is another kind of knowledge, another kind of learning, another kind of skill that's fundamentally important, you know, about how do we manage, how do we learn to swim in these wild, you know, torrential waters that are so out of our control. And if we don't learn that, and then all of the other knowledge we have can become very useless, you know, can be carried downstream out of our control, and, you know, be the cause of a lot of mayhem, destruction, sadness, grief, hardship. And so, you know, the Buddha talks about this experience of life as the confluence of the coming together of these six streams of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, a stream of body, physicality, touch, and the stream of mind, of emotion, of knowing, of thought, of conception, you know, all these powerful forces. And that they're all coming together in this moment, you know, this present moment that we find ourselves in. And they're coming together in a wild, crazy, uncontrollable way. You know, it is such a tumultuous experience, hard to fathom, so out of our control. You know, we talk sometimes, you hear of like, oh, you know, just come back to the present moment, you know, like as if the present moment was this really great thing. And it's not, right? You don't have to, you can sit here for 5 minutes and see that the present moment is very difficult to be with. If it was so great, we would all be hanging out there all the time, you know. But actually it's this like totally undependable, totally changeable, constant tumult of sense experience that's out of our control. It's the source of dukkha, right? The present moment is where dukkha is unfolding before us. And it's also happens to be the place where if we can build a relationship with it, if we can learn to swim in these waters, if we can learn to navigate and understand and see clearly, then yes, it is also the source of our liberation. You know, it will never be in the future, never will have been in the past. But to not misunderstand and to give ourselves some credit of like, why this practice is so hard. Why is it so hard to just sit here and try to observe what's happening? You know, it doesn't always feel like that vast a tumult, but the more and more sensitive we get, you know, sometimes it's just one stream of experience is very difficult. Sometimes all of them are very difficult. Sometimes it's not just that they're painful. Maybe it's there's a painful sensation in the knee or a painful emotion, you know, that we're experiencing. And sometimes it's just the wildness of it, right? The uncontrollability of each moment. And this despair of that can arise out of that, right? This longing for security, for stability, for relief, for safety. You know, that we do share. And how beautiful a longing that is, and yet how poignant. You know, largely because of the ways that we've learned to create stability are often not the ways that will get us across the stream. Right? That we are always creating some kind of raft, some kind of way to stay above the uncontrollability and the undependability of this constantly changing phenomena of these sense streams. And usually, you know, that's some form of grasping or some form of rejecting or some form of delusion, right? That just helps us feel a little bit stable, a little bit in control, a little bit hopeful, a little bit buoyant, you know, in this turmoil. And, you know, it's like, I can't say enough how important it is to recognize these things. You know, we talk the Buddha path about, you know, greed, hatred, and delusion as these problems, these things we're trying to overcome and get rid of, and we see them as poisons and, you know, their toxicity. And yes, you know, we, of course, they create problems for us and for others, you know. But we also have to see how understandable they are, right? Given the lack of training of our minds, you know, of course the mind is grasping on to pleasant experience. It's like, it's such a relief, you know, when the sun comes out. Of course. And of course the mind is rejecting and shying away from or trying to destroy unpleasant experience, right? That which we don't like. You know, being joined with the unpleasant, being separated from the pleasant, not having things the way we want them to be. These are real sufferings. Whether they seem petty in terms of just like, oh, our meal, we have preferences here and there, or, you know, bigger things in our lives, real loss, real harm in our life. So we have to also appreciate that craving, you know, greed, as we call it, right? That is creating a solidity. It's like we have to understand why it's doing what it's doing. It's this longing for safety, for security, for protection, for goodness, right? For relief from the hardship of things. Of course we want good. And the control and the aversion, the hatred or the fear towards that which is unpleasant, of course. Of course we run from the pain. It's not like pathological, you know. We have to understand these are understandable, legitimate defenses and delusion. You know, why does the mind just wander into fantasy and start thinking about things in the past or the future or this, you know, delusion of me-ness, you know, that we'll, of course, we'll talk more about, but this sense of self as the kind of ultimate delusion. Because if you think of all of these streams of experience of mind, body, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, you see that they're all just arising because of a past condition. And each moment of it dissipates when that condition changes. Each moment of mind, each moment of body, there's nothing core at the center of it. It's just propagated through action and through conditioning. And so it's amazing the mind can create this real solid sense of me, you know, here, sitting here with my history and my story and my hopes for myself in the future. You know, we can see the ways in which it feels like a prison, right? We see the ways in which we want to be relieved from, you know, this small me, the petty me that's so oppressive, you know, to ourselves and to others on one hand. But also, you know, is beautiful and it's on the other hand. And it's amazing. It's an amazing creation that we have, right? That we're creating ourselves, the sense of ourselves all the time. And to understand that it gives us a raft, right? It's giving our sense of a sense of a platform, of a vehicle in all of this tumult and all of this turmoil. And we think that that's like wrong, you know, or wicked, or it's just delusion. And we need to, you know, pull the plug on the self and stop believing in the self. And it's like, you know, this whole path has to, like, insight, liberation only comes through understanding, you know, not through just like behavior modification. You know, just not saying, don't, that's just the self. You know, it's like, oh, the self. What is this fascinating thing? Where is this me that feels like it's so angry, you know, or so sad, or that wants this thing so much? You know, what? Where is this? How is it serving me? Because it must serve us somehow. Otherwise, we couldn't keep doing it. It wouldn't keep showing up if it wasn't providing some kind of function that we felt like we needed. And a lot of it is, you'll see, it's just like, oh, it's a raft. It's a sense of me. It's a stability in the undependable, changeable, constant flux of everything. And rather than try to crush it or banish it, you know, can we just observe it? Can we appreciate actually that it's helping us stay afloat, you know, keeping us from drowning? Because maybe some of the other tools that we'll get into, you know, aren't developed enough in the moment, right? The mindfulness, the concentration, the equanimity, the loving kindness, right? These other rafts that we can build, these other tools we have to stay afloat and to cross this river, this great flood, as the Buddha spoke of. Can we appreciate this meanness and also see its equally changing and undependable nature? You know, sometimes you're like, why? You see yourself rehearsing the same thing, right, on retreat, day after day. It's like me, like, and then you see it and you see yourself doing it and then you keep doing it. You know, it's like there are these times where you just, it's like, or there's some song stuck in your head, you know, or just a story about whatever that you just are repeating, and you start to realize you're doing it and you get annoyed with it. But it just keeps going. It's very powerful to see that, like, oh, it's because we have to generate this me, we generate this sense of self, and then it disintegrates. Just like everything, every thought, it's gone. Every emotion, it's gone. It's like, in order to feel stable, it needs to keep generating itself. Right? That bhava, the becoming, the experience of becoming, it needs to keep like asserting itself into the future, the me. And so that relentlessness of it, it's good to get a sense of like, oh, it's exhausting, you know? The aversion to it, the weariness of like your own voice, just like, okay, you know, you get it. Like, I get it. And yet, okay, we have to get beyond the impatience with it too, and beyond the aversion, and have some sympathy of like, oh, there must be some reason why this is happening. And there's volition behind it, right? There's, it's like starting to see, oh, there is an intention to be, an intention to become, and asserting ourselves. Maybe there is a sense of insecurity. Maybe some of these other qualities of mind that we're cultivating don't feel really strong right now. Because when we are cultivating the other things, when you feel maybe a few moments of mindfulness, a few moments of just relaxation, we experience those things as dissipating. Maybe not for as long as we would like, you know, or we fantasize about our enlightened selves and being free from them, you know, forever. But it's like, well, we do have moments of rest and respite in the mind, of relief, putting down the fire of aversion, of craving, you know, of delusion for moments where things are okay. Even if they're painful, even if they're not our fantasy of how they might be, a sense of just acceptance and relief and settling into the truth, right? There's like a value that we start to see in just the truth of things and a relief of that. Even if the truth is unpleasant, we prefer it to the delusion that's exhausting us, you know, that takes so much energy to keep generating. You know, usually in the first couple of days of retreat, there are particular things, you know, tendencies of the mind, patterns that are called the, we talk about them as the hindrances, is one translation of this word, nivarana. You know, sense desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, and doubt. You know, and of course, we can have those at any time in our practice, any time of the retreat. But you definitely, we tend to notice them more in the first days, you know, just that, the lethargy of like the bell rings and it's like, oh my God, drag yourself to another sitting, you know, or just this kind of sleepiness that is inexplicable. You know, you felt like maybe you got a good night's sleep and whatever, but you sit down on the cushion and maybe you're even energized, you know, during the day and you sit down on the cushion and suddenly there's just this like, you know, that whole game. You know, and it is, it's frustrating, it's annoying. You see, oh, you put all this energy, you took all this time off, you want to show up, you want to, you know, fight dragons, and you're just like, you know, like conking out on the cushion. And yet that's worthy, you know, it's so worthy, it's so powerful, a flavor of protection of the mind, you know. You'd be like, oh, that's one way the mind protects itself from the intensity of reality. It's like, we're just going to shut off, you know? And so is there anywhere we can appreciate that sense of like, wow, this must be a protection because, you know, maybe I'm not really tired on some other level of what you think of as tired, but the mind knows how to induce a kind of delusion, induce a kind of fog because it just feels too intense. The voltage of the stream of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, the body, mind, schedule, just the stress of a new place, a new people, and a new thing. It's like, oh, boom, you know, just turns kind of gray. Or the restlessness, you know, where you feel like, oh, are you going to like waiting for the bell to ring? You're just like going to run out of the hall or, you know, so much energy. Or when you have both, you know, the restlessness and the sleepiness at the same time. It's like, and doubt often really understood as and referred to as really like the most dangerous, you know, because it's not considered like healthy skepticism. There's a good, you know, the Buddha was like, don't just believe what I say, explore it for yourself, you know, check this out for yourself. So this isn't meant to be something of just blind faith. You know, you just listen to what we say and you believe it. It's important to hear, you know, what we offer, what others offer, and test it out and explore and use it as a framework for being interested in investigating one's own experience. This kind of unwholesome doubt is different, right? It's not a it's not a skepticism that says, let me investigate. It's the kind of thing to be like, this is ridiculous. I can't do this. This isn't my community. These people don't know what they're talking about. Whatever, you know, whatever that voice that's just like dismissive and disengaging, you know. And again, we have to appreciate, oh, this is a protection. There's a sense of fear, of danger, you know, of not wanting to get kind of more intimate with what's happening in our hearts, maybe. And so the doubt is a way of kind of protecting. Can we honor that? You know, can we respect it without believing it, without buying into it? Oh, what are the thoughts around that? What are the physical sensations that arise when I'm in a very doubtful place? You know, are these the familiarity of certain storylines, you know, of certain melancholy sometimes? You know, it's like, oh, this sadness, I don't like it, but it's comforting. Something about it is like, feels so familiar. It feels like home. What is that? You know, how fascinating. This, the way that the mind defends itself and protects itself. And can we be interested in them versus thinking, kind of like what Matthew was saying earlier, anything we reject, you know, starts to have this kind of control over us. We're not banishing these things, but we also see that they're, you know, they can be taxing. So, you know, it's hard, but how do we build a relationship with the sleepiness, build a relationship with the restlessness, with the worry, with the doubt, with the wanting, with the aversion? Not easy, but worth it. And there is a place where it's important to see, oh, okay, where is this raft bringing us? You know, in this moment, I'm caught up in a storyline, I'm caught up in some tumult, and it's like the raft I'm creating of me, you know, or the raft of this story or of this view. That's so much of how, you know, we create the sense of stability and security is our perceptions, our views about the world, about ourselves, about each other. It's not that they're wrong. You know, it's like you can believe all your views. That's fine. But I'm sure they're right. You know, it's like you don't need to, you know, sometimes our views are right or they're legitimate, you know. But it's like on the Dhamma level, on the practice level, what are they serving? You know, you might have a totally right analysis of a situation, but when you come to practice, you see that all it's doing is trying to solidify this me-ness, you know, or the worldness. And it's keeping things solid. It's keeping things constructed. It's keeping things under our control, you know, in a way that feels safe for us. We understand this. We've got this locked down. This is how things are. And that certainty, right? And everything that comes with that is this ball of tightness around that which is always disintegrating. And so it's like, okay, does this raft we're creating, is it designed to get us across the stream, right? To get us across this flood? Or is it designed to really cast us downstream, you know, into more of tumult and more turbulence in our lives and in the world? Always worth looking at. Okay, I've built a raft. This raft of what? X or Y? How is it serving me? Is it helping me get across this river? Is it helping me create more turmoil in my life, right? Being pulled downstream into the rapids. And so, you know, lucky for us, the Buddha has tools that he offered of creating a different kind of raft, you know. And how beautiful. And of course, there are rafts that are beautiful and wholesome that are not just the Buddha's rafts, but important to look at these, you know, particular teachings. And there are, you know, many, there are more, sorry, I have to really modulate myself with this sound system. There are more wholesome rafts in the mind than unwholesome rafts. Important to know that, you know, to remember that. You know, all of the beautiful qualities of heart that we have access to, you know, these are encouraged, and there are so many different formulations of them. They're so beautiful, so important. You know, the seven factors of awakening, you know, that we talk about, of mindfulness, investigation, energy, rapture, calm, concentration, equanimity. These Satta Bodhanga, the seven factors of awakening, that's one framework for a raft that the Buddha talks about a lot. In fact, the Buddha loved it so much, like when he was sick, he would ask Ananda or other monks to talk about the seven factors, to inspire him, you know, help him feel better. You know, it's a beautiful formulation, these qualities of mind that help us get through mindfulness, right? Rather than mindlessness. It keeps our lives away from inevitability and towards freedom and possibility. Just this observation, the simple kind of non-intellectual, even non-verbal relationship of awareness with whatever is happening. Sometimes we add a word, you know, to help us connect, to help us acknowledge what we're seeing. Oh, pressure, tightness, tension, sadness, longing, worry, doubt, love. You know, that gentle mental noting can be an aspect of mindfulness, right? That helps us connect the kind of thinking mind with maybe the heart experience of knowing that's pre-verbal. And that's the pinnacle, you know, of all of these factors and of all of the other things that we may mention, this quality of mindfulness, of sati, that's observant and sort of transparent, right? It doesn't necessarily have its own flavor, but it can understand the flavor of whatever it's in relationship with. So this, you know, oh, I have a pain in my knee. It's like, okay, there's this I have a pain in my knee, you know, and it's like, okay, it is one level of reality, and we can relate to that, and we understand that, and we know how to translate that and what that means for us. But then there's like, okay, well, with our eyes closed, what's the direct experience, you know, of these sensations in this area of the body? You know, do I feel like I'm kind of up here watching this area down here, or is the mindfulness here? Right? Is the mindfulness a knowing in response to the experience itself directly in the body? Right? Oh, and it's pressure, it's tightness, there's throbbing, there's heat. It's not just pain, right? Which is an idea. Pain is a concept. It's like the mindfulness is like, oh, it's this direct experience. And it is part of what that next factor of investigation. Oh, well, what is this really? What is really going on, right? Kind of needing that genuine interest in the experience rather than just recoiling or just grabbing onto. Well, what is this? Maybe we name it those kinds of labels. Maybe we, you know, there's a way of referring to all physical experience of just, and like the elements, oh, earth element, hardness, right? Air element, pressure, tightness, water element. You know, sometimes it can feel like, okay, we notice moisture, we notice dryness, that spectrum. Sometimes it's just that sense of congealedness, right? Water element that binds sensations together. Fire element, right? Oh, heat, that range from heat to coldness, from pressure to fluidity, from moisture and dryness, earth element of hardness to softness. You know, this investigative exploration of the body on its own terms, you know, not just on a kind of conceptual experience of my body. Watching the breath arise and pass, it's like, oh, wind element. Tightening, tightening, releasing, tension, expansion, releasing, contraction. You know, can we bring a sense of concurrent attention to experience over time? That's where mindfulness and concentration come together. So mindfulness lasts just a moment. It's like we're there, we're with something, and then it's gone. And it's beautiful. One moment of mindfulness is incredible. It's a miracle. And then what's so hard is like, right, where can we bring it back? Can we bring it back? Can we have a continuity of mindful attention with a particular experience over time? You know, watching the breath come to rise fully, watching this sort of space attention, watching it dissipate. Often at the falling of the breath, you know, there's like this sort of blank space. Often we'll see that's where the mind wanders because there's nothing too kind of concrete to hold on to. Sometimes it's helpful in that space. Oh, bring the attention to something else. Bring it to hearing for just a moment. Oh, and then you notice the rising again. You know, or bring it to the more firm sensations, you know, at your seat or where your lips are touching, right? There's that point of contact or where the hands are touching. It's hard to keep continuity, you know, with any experience. And sometimes we think that's all mindfulness is the concentration. And we get tight in the mind, oh, trying to follow the breath, trying to follow this experience. And it's like, what we have to see is that tightness actually dulls the mind. You know, it's like a constipation of the mind. It's like, okay, if you see yourself doing that, oh, if you feel that affect, my new word I learned today, right? It's like, maybe it's a warning that that's not kind of balanced energy, right? The third factor of awakening, mindfulness, investigation, energy, because just the investigation, the natural interest in things will build energy. Interest in sleepiness will build energy. You don't need to force it. You don't need to. An energy that's identified as, oh, me doing this, I'm going to get this, I'm going to get enlightened, I'm going to whatever. It's like, oh, it's a dull weapon, you know, a dull tool and a kind of energy that can never match the natural energy that arises through this just gentle application of mindfulness over time. And that can lead to this word piti, which sometimes is translated as rapture, sometimes just like a kind of engrossment, you know, the sense of when you just feel like naturally enthralled with what's happening. You know, it might be painful, it might be pleasant, and there's a little bit of like breaking out of that. It's like, oh, sometimes it's that clue of like you're just as interested in something painful as you are pleasant, right? That like, it builds into a sense of like, oh, engrossment with the truth. You're not enchanted with it because it's pleasant, you're not afraid of it or trying to dig it out because it's unpleasant. There's just a natural enthusiasm because it's true. And that starts to lead to a calming of the mind, right? We're not battling. We're not antagonizing the mind. We're not antagonizing the body with mindfulness. We're just being with things as they are, which leads to a calm, a settling of the mind, a stabilizing. And that calm, right, which can be very pleasant and subtle, can lead to a deepening concentration, a deepening engrossment, concurrence with the mind, which itself can lead towards a deeper equanimity, right? This more balanced, peaceful state of just acceptance of things as they are. And these seven factors, they don't always arise. It's not always sequential like that. That's one way of looking at them. Sometimes they're just in and out of balance. Sometimes you have a lot of equanimity, but not a lot of interest. Right? Sometimes the concentration is strong, but the energy is really weak. That you see a lot. You'll see it's like, oh, you're especially in the first days where you're like, oh, you feel like you're kind of like dropping in, you're getting quiet, you're getting concentrated, and then suddenly you're like, I'm asleep. You're asleep. What happened? You know, and it's like, it's not personal. It's just, there's this period of, I mean, it happens forever. It's maybe more volatile in the beginning of a retreat where it's like, they're just not in sync with one another. Some of the forces are a little stronger. Some are out of balance. And that's the practice, right? It's not like the practice is like, we're only practicing well if everything is in perfect balance all the time. No, we're practicing with the wildness, right? Of like, oh, no, well, but to have that framework of like, oh, what just happened? And you're just like, oh, I have a lot of peace, but I wasn't really interested in what just happened. And so I ignored it and it built up in the background and became a bigger thing, you know, or I had energy, but not a lot of concentration. You know, that's the other side of more of the restlessness that can happen. And to not take it personally, right? To understand these are all kind of forces that are in flux in the mind, out of our control, but we can incline one way or another. We can learn, oh, well, this is what happens in this circumstance. This is what happens in this other circumstance. You know, it's not like we always have the perfect raft with all of the perfect beams and perfect lashing. You know, it's kind of cobbled together, you know, each time. We do the best we can with that. A few years ago, I started paddling, you know, in Hawaii and across Polynesia. There's a form of canoe paddling, outrigger canoe paddling that's, you know, ancient and honored. And so I've, you know, started doing more of that. And it's those kinds of canoes where it's like a very narrow canoe and then there's like a outrigger, right? So there's like these two bands and then a ballast there to kind of help keep balance. And, you know, I go maybe 3 times a week and it's kind of for fun. You know, there's like the hardcore people who are like regatta racers and I can't handle it. I know I go with like the lazy people, and the people who just want to have fun and kind of be out in the water, you know? And so we go out, you know, 3 times a week or so. And every time, you know, you get put in a different canoe with different people and it's not up to you, you know, you don't get to pick your team or whatever, you know, and it's just like the practice, you know, like some days it's like, wow, everyone is just like awake and on fire and you're really together and everything feels very synchronized and you're just zooming, you know. And then other times it's like, oh, this guy's cranky, you know, or this guy won't shut up, you know, or this woman's having a really hard day, or this person's like falling asleep. You know, it's like the sense of if you're just upset about your canoe, it's like, it's just, you're just going to suffer. That's all. That's all there is to do is just like complain versus it's like, okay, well, this morning, once again, all of us, the six of us are in different places and we're going to do the best we can to get from this shore to the other shore, given that, you know, given that I'm half asleep and this person really wishes they had gone swimming instead, or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And that's like all we're doing in the practice, you know. You can't expect that it's like the perfect racing team is going to be there every sitting, you know, or even for a moment of every sitting. Mostly it's like this other thing where it's like you're just in the canoe with all of these characters internally that show up and you do the best you can with those. And that we learn through that actually you start, you know, we start to appreciate that the point is not just being perfect all the time. The point is understanding our humanity, right? Understanding the sloth and torpor version, understanding the chatty version, understanding the, you know, whiny person, and understanding the arrogant person, right? Understanding the genuinely interested person. You know, that we have all of these parts of ourselves. And there's something really beautiful in that and really sacred in that and honoring that, you know, rather than just being like, this is the bad person, this is the bad person, this is the bad person. And then you're not going to go anywhere. You just sink, you know. Versus like, okay, we're just going to try moment by moment to kind of connect. Okay, mindfulness of this, mindfulness of that. Oh, we lose the thread. Okay, coming back, mindfulness. Of course, there are all these other beautiful, you know, there's loving kindness, there's compassion, there's patience, determination, renunciation, you know, many more beautiful qualities of heart that we can encounter and we will encounter. And you certainly have already, you know, and to feel good about those, even with sleepiness, can you recognize that, oh, there's also relaxation in that, you know, there's calm. Usually when there's sleepiness. And can we appreciate that? You know, there's only 7 factors of awakening, and one of them is calm. So it's like, that's amazing that you have calm. And just because it happens to also be brought along sleepiness doesn't mean you kick it out of the canoe, you know. You're on this raft, and this is who we're with, you know. There's a beautiful sculpture I was just teaching up in Canada on the Vancouver airport. This artist, Bill Reed, was from these islands, Haida Gwaii. He was a Haida artist and really responsible for bringing back a lot of beautiful First Nations art traditions, you know, in his community, in the Northwest in general. And he has this amazing sculpture there called The Spirit of Haida Gwaii, and it's this giant canoe. And it's got all these beings in it. You know, it's got the raven, and it's got the eagle, and the mama bear with the 2 little bear cubs, and the wolf, and the shaman, and this other human being that's the ancient reluctant conscript, just paddling, you know. And they're all crazy. They're all like, you know, they're all like fighting each other and giving each other a hard time, and you know, the shaman's on the back trying to like see clearly like where they're going, you know, and the paddler's just paddling. And yet it's such a beautiful metaphor, you know, that's of course from his own culture and so individual and unique in that way, but something so universal, right? That it's become a symbol that's so much greater than that for, you know, people as a planet, for all of us individually and what we carry in our hearts. You know, why do we want to banish these parts of ourselves that aren't cooperative, you know, that aren't just acting how we want them to be? Do we have to understand that the self is just as undependable as everything else externally? And yet coming into relationship with it, trying to understand it, making peace with it, not antagonizing it, but through understanding, oh, these entanglements they open up, they are liberated through insight. But it takes a patience, it takes softness, it takes caring, determination, mindfulness, you know, all of these beautiful things to do it. It's very important to not dismiss the true moments of peace that we have. It's very rare that they last long enough that you feel like satisfied, you know, really in your practice. The beauty of a moment of relief, you know, of putting down the struggle, just being with the body, with the senses, with the mind, whatever's happening. You know, of course we want more of that when it happens. Of course we long for that to simply just be the way we are, you know, that the mind has so fully untangled from its need for delusion as a raft that we just are in the open waters. We just swim. We don't need to do that. You know, it is such a beautiful aspiration. You know, even the Dhamma, you know, the Buddha talks about this, the raft, you know, I've created a raft for you to get to the far shore. But that the raft is not the shore. You know, once you get to the other shore, you don't need to carry the raft around, you know. It's like, no, you let the raft go. You know, so all of the teachings, all of the frameworks, all of the beauty, you know, that is this, to know that also it's like, it's also impermanent. It's also constructed. It's also, you know, fabrications, you know, constructed things. We can let go of them. And we want that freedom, you know. And it's so beautiful. It's considered the wholesome wanting, chanda, right? This longing for that freedom. You know, we don't have to beat ourselves up for wanting to be free. But we also can see that that wanting is painful. And that the wanting is the thing that keeps us from being free. You know, so there's a paradox. And we live with that entanglement, you know. But that there are times, and maybe they're for 2 seconds, maybe they're for 5 minutes, maybe they last longer, where it feels like we can kind of let go of the form and the structure and the method because the attitude is so purified, you know, the sense of perspective feels so released. But then it's not like shameful to also then go back to method, right? Go back to the structure of the form when that changes. You know, the equanimity arises and it also passes, you know, when conditions change. And it's like, oh, okay, we just go back to following the breath. You know, go back to, okay, feeling the body, noticing sound, seeing the way that the mind is trying to cobble it all together, sometimes very frantically. Oh, can we feel caring, you know, compassion for the mind that feels like it needs to always be doing that, creating this sense of structure to feel safe. And as we watch it, as we empathize with, as we care for it, it's like, oh, the system will start to trust us that we're not abandoning its safety when we find a deeper safety in just the truth, right? That the deeper safety that mindfulness can develop of not needing to make anything out of anything. There's hearing, there's seeing, there's tasting, smell, body, mind, arising and passing based on conditions. None of it needs to be clung to. None of it needs to be rejected. None of it needs to be made more than it is. This, just this, right, is the end of stress, the Buddha said. In the seen, there is just the seen. In the heard, there is only the heard. In the cognized, in the thought, in the formulated, there is just the cognized. Right? We don't need to create the raft of me-ness in it. And we abide in that relief when it's available. And then when the mind needs safety, when it needs the structure, oh, we watch it. We don't fight it. We see that. Oh, okay, me. Me, 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 me. Watch it, follow, and it dissipates. You know, the good news is this the raft is disintegrating every moment. Woohoo. You know. The bad news is that feels scary, you know, most of the time. And so we're always reconstructing it. But the more the mind is okay with reality, the less it needs to construct it. And that's just the practice. Watching sounds arise and pass, watching bodily sensations arise and come and go on their own, clinging, rejecting, wanting, spacing out, all of these things. This is the practice. And you cannot measure it, you know, as Matthew was saying, you cannot measure it based on what you think should be happening or want to be happening. It's totally irrelevant, right? There's just what's happening. And if you see it, then you're winning. You're crossing, you're finding your way across. And that's wonderful. So let's just sit for a minute together. So thank you for your attention and thank you for your practice. You know, it's like been super quiet in here all day, and really, you know, for a first day of retreat, it's pretty remarkable. So, you know, I know there's always doubt and there's always evaluation, but you know, from where we sit, it's just like, we hope you all, we really feel like you should feel just really good about yourselves, right now. And know that as, you know, evening comes and you have a little food and maybe the energy starts to wind down, that you don't need to, you know, you can kind of follow the arc of maybe, you know, the energy kind of, you know, coming down, and that's okay. You don't need to be cranking it up. And if the energy goes up, no, follow it up.